Dive into the chilling new Hulu original series, Under the Bridge, the riveting adaptation of the best-selling true crime book. Based on shocking true events, Under the Bridge tells the haunting story of a murder that lays bare a small community's darkest secrets. Go deep into the hidden world of the town's tormented teenagers as detectives race to solve the sinister crime. Starring Riley Keough and Lily Gladstone, Under the Bridge is now streaming with new episodes Wednesdays, only on Hulu.
Ma'am, what's going on?
I don't know.
I got a phone call. They said your father was found killed in his home.
I can remember his face was laying face down in the garage.
How many times had he been stabbed?
11.
That does not sound like a random burglary.
He had no idea that he was in any danger. I hate knowing that.
While they're standing in the kitchen talking, they see a flash.
He was staring at the door like he was looking for someone or watching someone. He gave me the creeps.
Some kind of a triangle thing is going on.
I'll be honest with you, I love that woman.
Jealousy and rage. That's what we have here.
This is a huge whodunit for sure.
Well, I didn't.
This is remarkably still not over.
Still not over.
There's always that lingering doubt. Are you going to solve this?
Dance.
Memories of a family man.
She's a dancing girl.
A doctor.
He is the most intelligent person that I know.
A lover.
He would look at me and he would say, "How did I ever find you?"
A good man.
He was the ultimate support system for everybody in his life.
Finally, savoring life's rewards. Until he found himself in the crosshairs of someone's obsession.
There's tons of gossip and innuendo, especially in a small town in West Texas. I mean, this story on its own is so sensational.
July 11th, 2012. A warm summer afternoon in Lubbock, Texas. Landscapers Becky Sherbet and Nathan Gilmore were getting down to work outside this spacious home. The owner, Dr. Joe Saunier, was the chief pathologist at a local hospital. As they walked around the yard, someone pulled up to the house.
It was a girl from Dr. Saunier's lab, and she was concerned that Dr. Saunier had not shown up.
Odd, because it was a weekday, and they assumed the doctor wasn't home.
I mean, I certainly don't know his work schedule, but I know him as a person. He would not be late. So we all walked to the front, and I was thinking maybe he was sick, and I was concerned. And we rang the doorbell, and we couldn't ever get anyone to answer.
So the three of them, the landscapers and the woman from the doctor's lab, went around to the back.
The back of the house is all windows. And I thought maybe I could knock on his window and just make sure he was okay. When I got to the back, one whole section of windows had been just laid over in the house.
They peered inside.
And there was a Gatorade bottle, which was kind of a strange thing. And you could tell something terrible had happened.
So the young lady behind us, Amelia, went in and I went after her.
That's when Nathan found a shell casing on the floor, and Becky called 911.
911, what's the emergency?
Somebody has broken a window in the back, and the doctor did not show up for work today. There was a bullet that was laying on the ground.
Okay, was it an actual bullet, or had it already been fired?
I don't know. I didn't pick it up. Somebody else went in and walked in. I'm not here. I'm not going in.
Nathan and the woman from the lab continued searching through the home.
And she starts looking in the rooms, and it's a big home. And it seemed like it took forever to go through that home.
They searched further and eventually made their way to the garage. And that's where they found Dr. Joe Saunier sprawled out in a pool of blood.
And I can remember his face was laying. And she automatically started crying, and she said his name, Dr. Saunier. And she knew that he'd passed.
Nathan returned to the backyard to his coworker Becky. His face told her everything. She was still on the phone with 911.
Is he here? She can tell there's something. It's not good. Oh, no! Oh, God!
Ma'am, what's going on?
It's coming. I don't know.
Detective Zach Johnson was sent to the scene.
What was your reaction when you heard the address of the murder?
I was a little surprised. I knew that we were going into an affluent neighborhood. We were going into a very low crime neighborhood.
An officer at the house briefed him when he arrived.
I was told we have a deceased person in the garage of the home. We don't know exactly how long they've been there. There is blood coming out from underneath the body, and the blood had actually traveled from underneath this body all the way underneath the garage door. And the garage door was closed.
Dr. Sonier's body was riddled with bullets and stab wounds. What happened? The first guess was an easy one. It could have been a botched burglary.
You know, your first instinct is, man, somebody broke into this house in this affluent neighborhood, probably to take some things of great value, and they were surprised by the homeowner.
But not in this case.
There were no signs of anybody going through looking for things to try to take. And the way that that house was set up, I mean, you could look in there through that window. I mean, and if you were like a burglar, you would be, oh yeah, this is a big score. And all of those wonderful pieces of artwork and items were still in place, hadn't even been touched.
The detective moved through the house, trying to imagine what happened.
I just walked up and visualized the point of entry. And from where I was at, I could see that the window was pushed in. There was no broken glass, which is very curious to me.
Johnson also noticed an overturned chair near the dining room table, a glass tumbler with spilled liquid, and those shell casings on the floor.
And there was a thought that maybe he had been at that table fixing a drink or something, and he may have been surprised.
Bloodstains were found in the hallway to the garage. It appeared the doctor tried to get away from his attacker. And there was something peculiar about that Gatorade bottle found on the floor.
The bottom of it is blown out. And for the Gatorade bottle to be blown out like that, I just made the determination that it was possibly a silencer because we did have bullet casings in that immediate area.
How many times had Dr. Sonier been shot?
He had been shot 5 times.
And how many times had he been stabbed?
11.
What did that tell you right there?
A shooting is very hands-off, but a stabbing is very hands-on. It's very personal, in your face. And so you're dealing with a personal killing and a killer that had no problem with making sure that this person is dead.
But who and why Dr. Sonier? Soon, the detective would have a list of suspects. His grown children say the doctor seemed like an unlikely target for a killer.
There was nobody who could have wanted him dead in his personal life of friends and relatives and neighbors and things like that.
And something almost unimaginable. This was not the first murder in this family.
My mother was killed 2 years, almost to the day, before my dad was murdered.
Dr. Joe Sonier was handsome, well-liked, and successful. Now, his showcase home in Lubbock, Texas, was a crime scene. The doctor's body found in a pool of blood in his otherwise pristine garage.
How big was this case here in Lubbock, Texas?
It was probably the biggest high-profile case in Lubbock in recent memory.
Lubbock police notified his family. Missy Bartlett is his sister. Philip Prestwood is a close family friend. And Dallas Sonier is the doctor's oldest son.
How did you all get the terrible news of what had happened?
They said, your father was found killed in his home. Can you please let your family know? And would you please come to Lubbock? We need to sit down with you and the family members and talk. And so we got our family together. We met in Lubbock the next day.
they spoke with police when they arrived and learned the awful details of the murder.
Do you think about his last moments?
I do.
How horrible they must have been.
To think about him lying there, I hate that feeling. I hate that image. I hate knowing that.
It's a big boy.
And adding to the pain.
He was on the cusp of retirement age, spending time with his grandkids, travel the world, and it was just all taken away from him and as he was stabbed on his garage floor.
Dance.
Happy feet.
Joe Saunier was a man of means by the time he was killed, but it wasn't always that way.
We weren't poor, but just regular. Walked to school. He didn't have a car in high school. Went to public schools, public colleges.
Did he express an interest in medicine?
Yes.
From a young age?
Yes.
And when he grew up, Joe Saunier went to medical school, had a successful career, and a marriage that gave him a beautiful family.
What was he like as a dad?
He kind of had one rule. If you made A's and you were a respectful person, that you really didn't have any other rules. And we had a blast. We had a blast growing up.
Philip Prestwood lived in the same neighborhood as the Sauniers. He credits Joe with helping him turn his life around.
At one point in my life, my dad wasn't in the picture, and I didn't adjust to that very well. He took me in as a son, and, you know, I started doing fine in school and acting like a grown-up.
In 2001, Joe suffered a blow he never saw coming. His wife left him for another man.
And it floored him. It knocked him down a rung emotionally. And so he found himself in his late 40s, a single man with his three sons off to college and starting their adult lives.
And that's when Joe decided to make a change.
He remade his image after the divorce.
He picked up a hobby that turned into a passion. Ballroom dancing. It was social, challenging, and he was good at it.
I think that's probably why he liked the ballroom scene, is because he was making friends quickly, and he thought it was good.
Trish Berlanga was Joe's dance teacher in 2004, but she stopped teaching him and began dating him. They were together off and on until 2011.
He was a gentleman through and through. He opened doors, pulled out your chair, put on your coat.
There's not a lot of men out there like that anymore, the true gentleman, the chivalry.
No, there's not. He was a total package. He really was. He was a gentleman in every way.
How big was dancing in your relationship?
Wherever we went, we always danced, meaning that if we were in a store shopping, they always play music in stores. And we would just break out into a dance right there in the middle of the store, and the salespeople loved it.
Dance remained a mainstay of Joe's social life. You can see him here in this video.
He loved to do every style of dance, and I roll in.
Deborah Hollowell owned a Venue dance studio in Lubbock. Joe became a regular, dancing six nights a week, taking lessons and joining dance parties. He was good for business, she says.
It helped. A lot more people would come out here and dance while he was here because people loved him. People loved being around him.
And then one day, in 2011, after he broke up with Trish, Rochelle Shatina walked in the door. Rochelle was 49 years old and a divorced mother of four. She and Joe hit it off right away.
They were extremely happy. Every time I saw them, they were smiling and laughing and joking around with each other.
They'd only been going out a few months when Joe put her to the ultimate test, the meet my kids date.
My dad told us that he had been dating a new woman and he wanted to bring her over to a barbecue we were at. I thought she was sophisticated. I thought she was kind. I thought she was lovely.
So they just kept getting more serious. Was it evident?
Seemed like it, yeah.
They had been together for close to a year when Joe was savagely killed in his own home. Now, everyone in Joe's life was struggling to understand what happened.
There was nobody who could have wanted him dead in his personal life of friends and relatives and neighbors and things like that.
This was devastating enough, but even more tragic, it was the second murder in this family.
The worst part was my mother was killed 2 years, almost to the day, before my dad was murdered.
She had been killed by her second husband.
Looking back on it, the phone calls from the two police departments for each of their deaths was so similar that I felt like it could have been the same phone call repeated twice.
As for Detective Johnson, he knew this would be no ordinary investigation.
This was all hands on deck for this murder?
Yes, ma'am.
Detectives immediately began speaking with everyone close to Dr. Saunier, beginning with his girlfriend, Rochelle Shatina.
There was this big, creepy-looking guy sitting there, and he was staring at the door like he was looking for someone or watching someone. And he gave me the creeps.
Was someone spying on the doctor and Rochelle?
We were in the kitchen talking. It was dark outside. And Joseph and I both saw a flash from the outside. And I said, it looked to me like a camera flash.
Detective Johnson was surveying the crime scene. Rochelle Shatina, Dr. Joe Saunier's girlfriend, arrived at his home.
What's her demeanor? How's she acting?
She is distraught. She no makeup, clothed like she had been doing housework, like she had just got in her car and flew out to where we were.
He asked Rochelle to come to the police station. She was barely able to contain her tears as she spoke about Joe.
He's a sweetheart. He's beautiful dancer, and he was kind and handsome and tall.
How would you describe your relationship with Dr. Saunier?
He's the love of my life. He is the kindest man.
Detective Johnson asked Rochelle when she last saw or spoke to her boyfriend. She said Joe was supposed to call her the night before, but never did. So she sent him a text.
It was at 10:32. And I just said, long day, going to bed, and I didn't hear from him.
So tell me when the last contact you had with him was.
It was a phone conversation. We were texting yesterday afternoon.
And Rochelle also gave the detective other details she thought he should know. She said there had been some troubling incidents in the months before the murder. She believed someone was following her. One time, she noticed a strange man in the parking lot of her gym.
There was this big, creepy-looking guy sitting there, and he was staring at the door like he was looking for someone or watching someone. And he gave me the creeps. He saw me, and then he picked up his phone and just started talking into it.
And later that night, back at Joe's house, she said something odd happened in the backyard.
We were in the kitchen talking. It was dark outside. And Joseph and I both saw a flash from the outside. He said, did you see that? And I said, you mean that flash? And I said, it looked to me like a camera flash.
But the detective's key question for Rochelle was, could she think of anyone who might want her boyfriend dead? She gave the detective several names, beginning with her ex-boyfriends.
His name is Dr. Thomas Michael Dixon. He's a plastic surgeon in Amarillo. Mike was my boyfriend before I started seeing Joseph.
Where did you meet him?
I had gone in to get some Botox injections. He had a spa day or something, and I met him there.
What kind of a personality is he?
He is a very smart man. I'd say he has a, I don't want to say a temper, because he doesn't really, he can be mean-spirited.
Okay. Can you kind of describe what you mean by mean-spirited?
Well, if we would get into an argument or something, he would turn it around so everything was my fault. And I know that he blames me for our breakup.
They had been together about a year and a half, and it wasn't easy, she said.
It was volatile. It was up and down, and he was sweet when he thought he was going to lose me.
The crowning blow to the relationship was a birthday gift that fell flat.
There was a packet of tea that came in the mail. He had signed me up for tea of the month and he had it mailed to me. And it's like, really? You know, you couldn't even hand me something. Anyway, he thought that I was extremely ungrateful.
Did he know about your current relationship? Did he express any feelings or anything?
He knew that I was dating Joseph. He called him by name in a series of text messages trying to get me to go out with him. He said, I'm not asking you to stop seeing him. I just want you to see me too and give me a chance. And I told him that I didn't do that to him and I wasn't going to do it to Joseph.
So he wanted you to see him on the side, basically.
So you clearly needed to talk to Mike Dixon.
Yes.
Is he your next stop?
Yes. About 10:30 at night on the 11th of July, we are knocking on Dr. Dixon's door.
I'll be honest with you, I love, love, love that woman. I really did. I really had fallen head over heels. In fact, made a lot of life changes for her.
Did a broken heart lead to murder?
This is a huge whodunit for sure.
Well, I didn't.
Just hours after Joe Saunier's body was discovered, detectives set out on a two-hour drive to Amarillo to speak to Mike Dixon. They arrived at his home at 10:30 that night. The meeting was recorded.
What's going on?
Well, we've had a homicide in Lubbock, Texas today.
Okay.
And it involves a doctor.
Okay.
That is well known to you and your ex-girlfriend, Rochelle.
That is my ex-girlfriend.
Yes, sir. Yeah.
Was he very accommodating? Did he want a lawyer? Was it an easy thing happening?
Yes, he was very nice. He was, he and I sat down in his living room. He offered us something to drink and had no problem with us coming into his house and talking with him.
Sort of shocked that I'm brought up.
In talking with people, we get pretty much a history of everything.
Okay.
Who they've been with and all of that.
I hear you.
And then we've got to run down names and all of that. Believe me, you're on a list of like 8 million people. This is a huge whodunit for sure.
Well, I didn't.
Johnson wanted to hear about Mike Dixon's relationship with Rochelle, and he was quite open about it.
I knew when I saw her that I wanted to date her.
Okay.
You know, I sort of felt that way. My problem was I was married.
Oh, yeah. That kind of gets in the way, doesn't it?
Yeah, it did. And we started an affair.
Okay.
And I don't know. It was probably a year or so.
What was Rochelle's opinion about you being married and dating her?
She didn't seem to have a problem with it.
Okay.
Initially.
You said initially, when did she start taking an issue with it?
Oh, well, I don't think she so much took a huge issue with it. I sort of took an issue with it.
Okay. And how long did you and Rochelle, how long were y'all together?
We were sort of on and off. We started dating, I guess, in February of 2010, and sort of on and off dated, broke up. Reconciled, broke up, reconciled.
He talked about the good times.
She gave me attention. She was affectionate. She was appreciative of the things I did for her. For a long time in my marriage, I wasn't really feeling like I was appreciated. And here was a beautiful woman who appreciated me.
And the ups and downs.
You know, it was good. It was great. When it was bad, it was argumentative.
Their relationship ended, he said, over more than that Tea of the Month Club gift.
I just got divorced, but she put a lot of pressure on me to get married. I just wasn't ready to do that.
Dixon seemed to have nothing to hide. He readily admitted trying to woo Rochelle back after they broke up.
Now, at any point while she was dating Joseph, did you ever tell her, hey, it's cool to date him. I just want to date you too. You can kind of date me on the side.
I told her that in December when I was trying to get her back.
Okay, and she was like, no way, I don't want to do that?
Yeah, she said no one.
Okay.
And I could respect that.
He seemed to accept that it was over. He even had another girlfriend who was at the house when he was questioned.
I'll be honest with you, I love, love, love that woman. I really did. I really had fallen head over heels. In fact, made a lot of life changes for her.
Okay.
But just with time, it just wasn't something that worked.
Police wanted to know where had he been earlier that day, a Wednesday, when Joe Saunier's body was discovered. And where was he the day before?
At that time, we didn't know exactly a time of death. We didn't know what happened. So the best information I had was that Dr. Saunier was murdered that day. And so where was he that day? And now, you know, give me the time 24 hours before. Can you recall that?
So Dixon told the detective where he was, starting on Tuesday.
I was in the operating room in the morning.
Okay.
When he finished, he said he had lunch with his girlfriend, and they met up again later as well.
We met then for dinner last night at probably 6-ish. We had dinner.
Do you remember where you ate?
Uh-huh. We ate at Lemongrass.
After dinner, he said he went to his office for a while. Then he and his girlfriend were at home from 7:30 on. Wednesday was similar.
Went to the operating room, did cases till, I don't know, noon, 1 or 2 o'clock maybe. Did cases until then. Came back out here, messed with my giant dog, played around.
That's about the time Joe Saunier's body had been found more than 100 miles away in Lubbock. It seemed as if Dixon was nowhere near the crime scene. Plus, he was calm and cooperative.
We photograph his person to make sure he doesn't have any injuries. I get a DNA sample from him.
Did he have any injuries?
He had no injuries whatsoever.
On their way out, the detectives learned one other detail. On Tuesday night, after Dixon and his girlfriend got home from dinner, a friend had stopped by. The friend's name was David Shepard. Detective Johnson called him the next morning.
And the first thing out of his mouth is that, "Detective, you are wasting your time looking at Dr. Dixon. He's a very nice guy, and he has nothing to do with this."
Sure enough, Shepard vouched for Dixon. Yes, he was at his house that night to pick up cigars.
His alibi is checked out.
They did. We had checked him out. Surgeries is where I was. We went to the restaurant to see if we could obtain a receipt from them. And he had also said, "I can even fax you the receipt that I was at this particular restaurant on this day and time."
Are you thinking, okay, he's probably not involved?
Yes, I didn't have anything to tell us that he was involved.
A promising lead that went nowhere. Detective Johnson moved on. There were more people to investigate. The women in Joe Saunier's life. Did Joe's former dance instructor and girlfriend make a wrong step?
According to Rochelle, the relationship had not ended on a very good note.
So this woman in Rochelle's eyes was maybe looking for revenge?
Sure.
Rochelle, anything and everything that you can tell us.
Rochelle Shatina had lots to tell Detective Johnson when they spoke that first night. She suggested he talk to her ex-boyfriend, but that didn't pan out. He had an alibi. Plus, he was a respected doctor who had never even met Joe Saunier. Now, the detective focused on some other possible leads Rochelle had mentioned. Months before Joe died, Rochelle received a bizarre letter. It was from someone Rochelle had never heard of, a woman named Tina.
She met Joseph on the internet, and that they had sex for money, basically. And, you know, she and her daughter lived in this place, and Joseph hasn't been paying, and she's going to lose her place.
The money stopped, Tina's letter said, and she was angry.
She trusted him because he said he was a doctor and that he's a... She said, "I hope this hurts him as much as he has hurt us."
Joe adamantly denied knowing this person.
He said, "First of all, story. I've never paid for sex in my entire life." And he said, "You know, this is obviously someone trying to drive a wedge in between us."
Joe also told his family about the letter.
My dad's only reaction to that letter, immediate reaction, was, "That is not me. Take that letter to the police right now."
He was serious.
Because he was innocent of anything that letter stated. That letter was a farce.
The detective wanted to know more. The letter had been postmarked in Lubbock, but since the mysterious woman gave no last name, there wasn't much to go on. So Johnson turned to two other women who Rochelle thought might have a reason to harm Joe. They were less mysterious. They both had actually dated the doctor. One was an old flame who couldn't get over their breakup. So upset, she continually left messages, sometimes full of vulgarities, on Joe's phone.
She has called and called and called to the point when he's had to hang it up or had to turn off the ringer. And then Joseph would get these horrible text messages, you know, calling him a and, you know, you're such a and whatever. And the next day it was like, hi, do you miss me?
Do you know when the last time he received any communication from her?
Wasn't that long ago.
So if I can't have him, no one can type Correct. Motive?
Investigators spoke to her and ruled her out.
There was just nothing there at all.
What about that second ex-girlfriend?
Who's this other person that you think could have done this?
Rochelle told the detective that relationship ended just before she met Joe.
And they had an on-again, off-again relationship for about 7 years. She wasn't happy about it.
Has he ever complained to you, she will not leave me alone?
And she kept calling and calling. And finally, I think about a month ago, he talked to her. And he said, I think we both need space, and I think you just need to back off. And she started crying, and she said, I just wish we had another chance. And I don't know what else was said, because I didn't want to ask too many questions.
Do you recall, I guess, she expressed any violence or anger towards him, or was it more of a just please take me back, take me back?
What I got from Joseph was just please take me back, take me back. But I don't know. He wouldn't have told me.
He wouldn't have? Okay.
He wouldn't have wanted me to know that.
Okay.
According to Rochelle, the relationship had not ended on a very good note.
So this woman, in Rochelle's eyes, was maybe looking for revenge?
Sure. Yeah, revenge. Maybe she wanted to get back with him. And he told her, no, I'm in love with Rochelle. A lot of those were pretty credible reasons that we had to consider.
This woman was Trish Berlanga. You'll recall she was Joe's dance instructor before they started dating. Trish had already called police when she learned about the murder, offering to help.
What kind of questions are they asking you?
Well, of course, where I was. Did I want to see him dead? And, like, just really ridiculous questions, I thought.
Did they ask you if you killed Joe?
Yes. Yes, they asked me point blank.
What did you say?
No. Absolutely not.
And according to Trish, what Rochelle told police about her never happened.
Rochelle said that you frequently reached out to Joe until he finally had to tell you it was over and essentially to stop.
Huh. If two phone conversations in 10 months and two text messages is a lot, I guess I don't see it that way. I was not begging him to get back together. I knew he was with Rochelle. I don't go around and break people up, even if it's someone I love.
After speaking to Trish, detectives knew they were looking at the wrong woman.
We pushed her buttons, tried to get any kind of motive out of her for jealousy, and it was obvious that that woman was deeply in love with Dr. Saunier. She never wished ill on him for a minute. It was obvious to us that she had nothing to do with that murder.
I love her too.
But what about Rochelle? She seemed helpful, maybe too helpful. Police wondered if she could possibly be trying to deflect attention away from herself.
Rochelle is telling you all these things, that she's being stalked, they're being stalked. Are you able to rule her out as a suspect?
Not at that very moment. You've got to consider, as an investigator, okay, she's given me three names, and she's given me a lot of details about all these three people. Is this a misdirection, or is this a legitimate, I want to tell the police what I know? At that point, I don't have that luxury of not looking at her as a possible suspect.
Please state your name now.
Rochelle Chatina.
Okay.
So the detective took a closer look at Rochelle's story. Remember, the night before his body was found, she said Joe was supposed to call her at home, but never did, and he never answered her texts.
In my mind, this is the love of her life, but we don't go to the house, we don't call anybody to go and check on him. To me, that was a little bit suspicious because I'm thinking, okay, well, are you not checking on him because you know what they're going to find?
And when Johnson spoke to the family, he learned the relationship wasn't as perfect as it seemed. The issue? Marriage.
Was he open to marriage again?
I don't think that he was looking for that. He was finding himself free to explore the world, explore women. I don't think he wanted to settle down.
Was Rochelle content with just, you know, being boyfriend and girlfriend and just enjoying life?
Based on what Joe told us repeatedly and how stressed out he was, no, she was putting the clamps on him to get married.
All of this raised a red flag for police.
Rochelle is on your radar.
Yes, she is.
Did you think this is going to be a tough one to solve?
It was going to be a tough one to solve, but there's one rule in homicide, and it's somebody always knows something.
In this case, someone seemed to know everything.
He's been relating these stories to me about this thing that he did.
After Dr. Joe Saunier's brutal murder, his family was inundated with sympathy from people all over Lubbock.
People from Dance, Covenant Hospital, strangers on the street would come up to us and tell us how much he meant to them.
Waiters at restaurants were coming up to us and telling us a story about when my dad used to eat there and how nice he was to them, and they remembered that.
Detectives, meanwhile, had interviewed several women who had been involved with Dr. Saunier, including his current girlfriend, Rochelle Shatina.
Did she stay on your radar? Did she start to kind of fade away as a suspect?
She faded away once we gauged her and looked at her phone records, locations, and involvement. There was just nothing there to connect her.
They hit a dead end.
You were essentially out of leads.
Yes, we were.
Did you think this is going to be a tough one to solve?
It was going to be a tough one to solve, but there's one rule in homicide, and it's somebody always knows something. The question is, are they going to come forward?
July 15th, 4 days after Joe's body was found, someone did. Police got a call from a man with a crazy tale, a tale that would lead investigators down a road no one could have imagined.
He's been relating these stories to me about this thing that he did, and he said he shot a guy.
Special forces, were you? The caller's name was Paul Reynolds, a former Green Beret who was a nursing assistant and still in his scrubs when he came to talk to police. Reynolds lived in Oregon, but was in Texas staying with an old friend from high school. In the weeks before the murder, Reynolds noticed his friend was acting strange.
You know, he kind of started in with just weird talk. He claimed that he had been to Grenada, you know, and done this special op, you know. He was like, yeah, you know, and I killed these people, and these people died, and, you know, I just didn't believe it.
Yeah.
And I just thought he was just out there, you know.
And the stories continued.
Well, then it was, oh, by the way, you know, when my mom died, I kind of helped her along. I'm like, well, what do you mean? He's like, well, you know, I had some units of insulin, and I just gave her some extra, and then she just died.
Then it got worse. The friend tried to kill himself several times with sleeping pills, insulin, and he slit his wrist.
When after he did the suicide attempt, then it was, you know, I just don't want to be this bad, awful person anymore. I don't want to hurt people anymore. He's like, all I think about is killing people. He's like, I just want to kill people. And he suddenly told me, I have this list of 40, 50 people.
And that's when he told Reynolds that he shot a doctor in Lubbock. He was waiting for him in his backyard.
On this day, he said he was sitting there or something, and that the guy, this doctor, knocked on this window, or somehow the two connected. I don't know what happened. He just got up, he had this gun, and he shot the guy. And then he said something about pushing in a window. He said he just like went right through the window. And I was like, okay.
Did he get injured when he pushed this window in?
Yeah, he showed me these marks on it. Yeah, he's got, like on his left arm here, there's like some, not abrasions, but they're like bruises.
And did he say that the windows broke, they shattered, he was worried?
He said it didn't break.
That got Detective Johnson's attention. This detail matched what happened at Joe Saunier's.
He entered the home through a very large window, and the glass in the window didn't break. Well, nobody knew that. We hadn't released that information.
This is huge.
That's huge. That's huge.
That wasn't the only detail Reynolds knew.
Did he tell you how many times he shot this guy there?
He said he just shot him repeatedly.
Okay.
Yeah. He he said he emptied the gun.
Reynolds then went on to tell the detective about that Gatorade bottle.
Did he use any kind of devices, silencers, special elongated clips?
He said a Gatorade bottle.
Okay.
Yeah.
So he said he used a Gatorade bottle, I guess, to help muffle the noise or something?
Yes. Okay.
Well, we knew that was huge, too, because, once again, we hadn't released that information either.
So these are all little details.
These
that there's
are
no
little
way
details.
Someone
correct.
Could know who didn't have inside knowledge.
That is correct. That's correct.
And there was more. Reynolds said someone else was involved in the murder. Someone wealthy, prominent. Turns out, both people were names the detectives had already heard before. A motive for murder.
There was some kind of a triangle thing that's going on.
With a shiny payoff.
It was going to be 3 bars of silver.
It was almost the perfect crime. Everyone was distracted, their attention elsewhere. Stacks of cold, hard cash sitting on the table, unguarded. Who wouldn't be tempted to slowly reach their hand out and steal a pile of Monopoly money from the banker? Monopoly is one of those games that could bring out everyone's most devious selves, and Monopoly Go takes that gleeful mischievousness to your phone in a wildly popular twist on the classic that you can play throughout your day, anywhere, anytime. Collect rent from friends on iconic properties. Bankrupt them by pulling a heist on their vault. And Monopoly Go has timed tournaments where you can team up with friends to unlock big prizes and try to top the leaderboards. Whether you're helping out your friends or going head-to-head for riches, Monopoly Go is an absolute blast. Download it now free on the App Store or Google Play.
Investigators can search years for a clue to crack a case wide open. Some get a lucky break from out of nowhere. And that's what happened to Detective Zach Johnson in the Joe Saunier murder investigation.
You said yourself, someone always knows
somebody
something.
Somebody always knows something.
And there was your someone.
And there was our someone that came forward with the information.
That someone was a guy named Paul Reynolds. He told detectives his friend confessed to killing a doctor in Lubbock. And who was his friend? He was a man police learned about the first night of their investigation. His name was Dave Shepard.
What does your jaw do when you hear the name David Shepard?
I couldn't believe it. And I was like, I think we got him. I think we've got good information. Nobody knows this.
And Reynolds had more for the detective.
Did he go into any other details? Why did he do this?
Right. I mean, I asked some of the same questions.
Yeah. You know?
So there was some kind of triangle things going on.
Like love triangles?
I'm not sure.
Yeah, okay.
And there's some doctor, a doctor in Lubbock.
Okay.
And a girlfriend.
Okay.
The two of them had in common.
The doctor and Dave?
The two doctors.
Okay.
A girlfriend, two doctors, a love triangle? Guess who was also involved? Someone the detective already knew. Dr. Mike Dixon. Dixon, remember, dated Rochelle before she met Joe Saunier. They were the doctors in that love triangle.
I was like freaked out by the whole thing.
Reynolds then made a vague but ominous connection between Dr. Saunier and Dixon.
Something happened between these two that made Dave think that he needed to avenge Mike. And apparently Dixon was not only going along with it, but he was going to pay him to do it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sort of shocked that I'm brought up.
The detective, you'll recall, talked to Dixon hours after Joe Saunier was found murdered.
This is a huge whodunit for sure.
Well, I didn't.
Johnson had been suspicious of him from the start.
Your spidey sense was going off.
Yes, yes. There were a lot of issues here that happened during this time with him. But I don't have any probable cause to go and investigate this man any further.
For instance, that night when the detective interviewed Dixon, he didn't mention that Shepard had dropped by to pick up those cigars. That information came from Dixon's girlfriend, and he acted strange when asked about it.
And he stood very still. And then he collected himself, and we're back to the, oh, well, his name is Dave Shepard. Why do you need to know about him?
Now, that answer made sense.
Because he knows that David Shepard is involved in the murder. And he doesn't want me to link on to Dave Shepard and to talk to him.
And there was another part of Reynolds' story that added a critical detail to something police had already learned. He said Shepard had been stalking Joe Saunier.
He's been watching this guy.
For how long?
For weeks, apparently.
Was he watching him there in Lubbock?
I assume so.
Okay. Yeah. Did he tell you how he was watching him?
Apparently he was in this guy's yard.
Detective Johnson thought back to that flash Rochelle said she and Joe saw one night at his house.
It's dark outside, and Joseph and I both saw a flash from the outside.
And earlier that same day, she saw someone watching her in the parking lot outside her gym.
There was this big, creepy-looking guy sitting there.
Dave Shepard was a big guy, well over 6 feet tall, and some 300 pounds, so it could have been him.
Even at night, I could see the man inside the car because...
And it wasn't just Rochelle who thought someone was watching her. Deborah Hollowell, the dance instructor, told investigators she noticed a stranger watching her studio from a parking lot across the street.
Right around that area over there.
It was the studio where Rochelle and Dr. Saunier went dancing.
I would see him outside quite often when I would take my smoke breaks, hiding behind a semi-truck. I felt like he was just really staring over our direction.
Her description could fit Shepard as well. She said he was big and shaggy.
He was just staring, and that gave me such a bad feeling.
He was worried that these numbers were going to be traced back to him.
There was yet another detail Reynolds had for the detectives. The handsome reward Shepard said Dixon offered him to kill Dr. Saunier.
And it was going to be... three bars of silver.
Okay.
He got one early because he came into some money. And he told me about this bar of silver.
Dixon gives him a silver bar as an advance. And he gives it to him around Father's Day.
This bar of silver?
Sheriff's deputies were monitoring the interview as it happened.
Well, one of those deputies gets on a computer database, types in David Shepard's information, and there you go. There's a silver bar that Davis Shepard sold in Amarillo, Texas, around Father's Day. We have it confirmed.
Police were convinced they had their suspects. Hours later, a SWAT team showed up at Mike Dixon's house.
How shocked was he?
He was very shocked. He was very angry.
It was 2 a.m. when they brought him in for questioning.
I'm under arrest at 2:15 in the morning.
I have no idea what the hell's going on here. Do you want an attorney or do you want to talk to me?
Well, I don't know what's going on now.
Okay.
Did he start talking at all or was he still shut down?
He requested his attorney.
Now, do you prefer to go by Mr. Shepard or Dave?
David.
Okay.
Shepard wouldn't talk either.
Okay, so at this time, are you wanting to have a lawyer present?
Yes.
Police notified the Saunier family hours later. It was the day of Joe's funeral.
They told me that they had arrested David Shepard and Mike Dixon for my dad's murder. So it made the funeral slightly easier for us as a family because justice was on its way.
What did you know about Michael Dixon and Dave Shepard leading into that arrest? How much did you know?
We knew absolutely nothing about them other than Thomas Michael Dixon had dated Rochelle before my father. That is it.
They soon would learn plenty about a twisted and devious plan that led to Joe Saunier's murder. Double trouble from a very odd couple.
Dr. Dixon was very well educated. He had a successful business up in Amarillo. David Shepard, he was a con man. His life was just tanking.
Five days after Joe Saunier's body was found, police arrested Mike Dixon and Dave Shepard for his murder. and Detective Johnson began looking into their backgrounds as he built a case against them. By all accounts, the two appeared to be an unlikely duo.
What were you learning about Dr. Mike Dixon?
Dr. Dixon was very well educated. He had a successful business up in Amarillo. He was probably the best hand surgeon between Amarillo and Dallas.
He was extremely motivated in what he wanted to do, and he worked my whole life to build what he ended up creating was his practice.
Andrew Dixon is Mike Dixon's son.
He was a fantastic plastic surgeon. He kind of taught me, once you see something, no matter how hard it is, no matter how hard you have to work, you know, you can get it. You can achieve those things.
And he set an example for his son. Andrew says his dad worked tirelessly to build his successful practice. It also included cosmetic services. At one point, he even had his own talk show.
I get the patients that come in and say, I want to look like J-Lo or Beyonce.
His patients loved him.
Not just for the way Dixon made them look, he says, but how he treated them, too.
If people couldn't afford things or needed help, he was there to help them. And I remember at Thanksgiving, we would always load up food and go to his patients that didn't have a lot of family. So we would come in and bring him food and talk with him for a little while. And I mean, he was there for him and he cared about him.
Then there was Dave Shepard, Big Dave, as he was known, the polar opposite of high-achieving and charitable Mike Dixon.
Who was this man? What did he do? What was his story?
David Shepard, he was a con man, is what we came to learn about him. He had tried several business ventures for himself, anywhere from real estate to pharmaceutical sales. Personally, his life was just tanking. As soon as he came into money, he got rid of it, he spent it.
I just didn't believe it.
Yeah.
In his interview with the detective, Paul Reynolds said he'd known Shepard since they were teenagers.
How would you describe his personality?
Dave is a guy who can be very bombastic, outgoing, pompous, arrogant, obnoxious kind of thing.
Big Dave was known for the tall tales he told.
Was he full of you-know-what?
Yes.
He bragged about jobs he never had.
Let's run down some of the occupations that he's claimed to have.
Okay. Private investigator is what he claimed to be at one time.
True or false?
I believe that to be false.
Okay.
Sheriff's deputy, I believe it was Potter County. He even had a badge in his possession.
True or false?
That was false. He claimed to be a very successful businessman in every business venture that he had.
That was false as well.
He was a person that liked to put on a facade, that, hey, I'm on the up and up.
Instead, he was down and out, but that didn't stop him from living large. He spent time at cigar shops, strip clubs, and martini bars. Detective Johnson learned more about him from one of his bar buddies.
He portrayed himself as having money. You know, he would always try to dress nice, and he'd smoke a lot of cigars, but I found out after about 6 months from knowing him, didn't have the money that he portrayed.
So what brought the deadbeat and the doctor together? The two enjoyed fine cigars and saw each other occasionally at smoke shops in Amarillo. They became friends around 2010 when they both went through divorces.
And they kind of bonded over that poor misfortune, I guess.
Shepard's bar buddy told the detective he heard Shepard rave about Dixon.
He was always saying how much he liked him and how good of a guy he was. And it was one of those deals where it's like, oh, well, Dixon does this, and he drives a Porsche, and he has such a nice house.
And when you would see them together, Dave and Dixon, what kind of places did you see them together at?
Strip club Cassidy's.
Okay.
It was only at Butler's Martini Bar or Cassidy's is whenever I'd see them two together.
Okay.
The two friends became business partners in 2011 when Shepard had another one of his big ideas. In his interview, Reynolds said he was in on it briefly as well.
It's a business where you offer allergy testing to doctor's offices. And the deal is this Mike Dixon guy was going to be his medical director.
Andrew Dixon remembers meeting Shepard twice, once in a restaurant with his dad when they told him about that new business idea.
Didn't seem anything too off by the guy. But I didn't really have a lot of communication with him. I didn't have a lot of time to spend around him, so I couldn't really formulate a good opinion about him.
Another time was when his dad invited Shepard for Thanksgiving.
And, you know, he had told me that David was going through a rough time. And, you know, at the time I knew my mom and dad were kind of going through a rough time too. So I think they were going through things together at the same time, you know, to where they could kind of feel for one another. And that's what he told me. He said, David's going through a hard time, so he's coming Thanksgiving.
But now his father and Shepherd were behind bars, and Andrew was dumbfounded.
You know, my dad, no way, absolutely not. You know, he was somebody that valued the human life. No way he would ever be involved in something of taking it away. So you're thinking, this is crazy.
Crazier still when he began learning the details.
I mean, it's all just wild, you know. I mean, one of the smartest guys I know pays silver that can be tracked. You know, you're thinking, that's absurd.
Dixon and Shepherd stayed silent for months. Then Shepherd had a change of heart.
Dave Shepherd starts to fill in the blanks.
He does.
About what happened.
Yes,
next.
He does.
Is that true?
He started talking and wouldn't stop.
I promise I'll be compliant, won't cause any problems.
He wanted me to call the ex-girlfriend and lie to her, say that I was having sex with her boyfriend as well for money.
How a plot to get revenge turned deadly.
Point the weapon, discharge several times. After three or four discharges, he's backing away.
Three months after Joe Saunier's murder, Big Dave Shepherd was in a police interview room, ready to tell all. He cut a deal with then-District Attorney Matt Powell.
What the deal was is basically him tell the truth. If we felt that he told the truth, then we would let him plead guilty to life without parole and waive the death penalty.
Where were you during his confession?
I was in a different room watching it.
Watching as Shepherd told detectives how his bromance with Mike Dixon started.
He's quick-witted. I'm kind of a sassy smartass, and we just kind of hit it off.
And how they began spending more time together while they both went through their divorces.
We'd go out and have a drink, have a cigar, you know. All our other friends were married.
So y'all talked a lot about your personal lives to each
yes,
other?
Yes, sir. So, I mean, somewhat, like gentlemen do, I mean.
Dixon talked about the women in his life, like Rochelle Shatina. Shepherd even met her.
She's around 49, 50 years old. Smoking hot. I thought she was just lovely. I thought she was just a sweetheart.
Yeah.
Dixon was crazy about her, but it didn't last. And Shepherd told detectives when Rochelle took up with another man, another doctor named Joe Saunier, Dixon didn't like it one bit. The two buddies tossed around some bizarre schemes to try and break up Rochelle and Joe.
David tells Dr. Dixon, if you really want to get to Saunier, you know what you need to do? You need to order him some gay porn magazine, and you gotta send it to his office.
So did they do it or not?
No, they don't do that. Dr. Dixon's like, nah, man, that's not, I don't want to do that.
Another scheme they concocted to embarrass Dr. Saunier involved hiring a woman Shepherd knew from a gentleman's club named Sheena Teague. Detectives spoke to her, so did we.
He has a proposal for you. He said that his friend Dr. Dixon had been dating a woman and that she was now dating a doctor in Lubbock, and he wanted me to call the ex-girlfriend and lie to her, say that I was having sex with her boyfriend as well for money.
Did you say, why do you want to do this?
No, I more laughed it off and told him that I would think about it.
When you said you'd think about it, did he just drop it right away?
Yeah, we just kind of left it there. He never asked me again. I think he got the gist that I wasn't going to do it.
That idea sounded similar to that letter Rochelle received from someone named Tina. Remember, she alleged Joe paid her for sex. Police hadn't found her since she gave no last name. Now, they thought the letter might have come from Dixon and Shepherd.
On one occasion, I found them, followed them out.
And Shepherd had more.
He required me to spend more and more time by Dr. Saunier's house to try to pick him up and what his habits are.
He said Dixon sent him to Lubbock repeatedly to spy on Rochelle and Joe.
He tells me that Rochelle and her paramour, Dr. Saunier, take these dance classes. And he showed me where the dance class was, where to go.
There's no doubt in my mind they were stalking these guys, you know, months and months before the murder took place.
And detectives wanted to know how Dixon's obsession turned from merely creepy to downright diabolical.
Tell me how he told you, or how y'all discussed killing Dr. Saunier.
Initially, he wanted somebody to break in his house to make it look like, you know, just a home invasion, a robbery.
And you're talking about breaking into Saunier's house?
While he's there or when he comes home.
This is go time. We're not turning back. And Dave's like, oh my God, he wants this man dead.
Shepard said he then realized he would be the hitman for his friend Dixon. And he described step by step how he did it. Shepard said he got to Lubbock around 4 in the afternoon. He sneaked into Joe Saunier's backyard and waited for the doctor to come home.
I have my bag. In the bag is a gun with a Gatorade bottle on the tip of it, a knife, and a belt.
3.5 hours went by. Nothing. And then Shepard said he heard a rapping on the window. Joe Saunier was inside his house looking right at him.
I wave at Dr. Saunier and get up. And I walk to the window, and he has lowered the window about this far from the top down.
What happens when you walk up to the window?
I point the weapon, discharge several times. After 3 or 4 discharges, he's backing away. He's running across to the, I believe, the garage.
So he runs down that hallway. Is he out of sight for me?
Yes, sir.
Okay. What do you do next?
I push the window in. I don't know if he's going for a gun. I don't know if I've ever hit him. I don't know what's happening. So I push in the window and crawl in.
When you go in there, what happens?
I pretty much run around the corner as fast as I can. As I turn around, down the hallway, right into the garage, he's laying on the floor, not moving, not breathing, nothing. I check his pulse in his neck. He's dead.
But that wasn't enough for him.
I pull the knife out of my bag and I stab him in vital organs 2 or 3, 4 times.
After the murder, Shepard drove the 2 hours back to Amarillo. 24 hours later, he drove to a lake. It was around midnight.
I got the gun and I threw it back toward the lake.
You feel like despite everything he had done, he seemed quite credible?
If you look at what he was saying, match that up with everything else that we knew, it went hand in hand. So there wasn't very much doubt in our mind that he was telling the truth.
And the next day, Shepard led investigators to the gun.
I remember driving up, seeing a drainage ditch.
You brought David Shepard back here.
Yes. He says, I'll show you where it is.
Gentlemen, I'm going to give you my best estimate, my best recollection, okay?
He walked down one side of the lake and then stopped. He used a rock to demonstrate.
Do it underhanded, just like that. At an angle, it was in this quadrant. That's probably the closest I'm ever going to get you.
And he tosses that rock down there, and we've got the dive team guys over here looking, and we've got eyes on it. And sure enough, they go down.
So they follow the path of the rock.
They follow the path of the rock, and a couple of feet from the rock, boom, there's our murder weapon.
So now the DA had a confession and a murder weapon. And over the next year, lawyers on both sides negotiated the terms of the deal. In exchange for Shepard's statement, the death penalty was off the table. And in August 2013, he pleaded no contest to one count of capital murder.
Basically, he's confessing that he had been paid to kill Dr. Saunier.
But Dr. Mike Dixon wasn't interested in a deal. He was determined to fight. He insisted to his attorneys that he had nothing to do with the murder.
From day one, he made it very clear that he did not pay, he did not plan, and he did not participate in the killing of Joseph Saunier.
So Dixon would roll the dice and risk a murder trial. And what happened in court would be unbelievable. Disorder in the court.
He's on the stand, all's well.
Well, it wasn't all well very quickly. If there was probably ever a time in Lubbock County to have a camera in the courtroom, that might have been it.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
You ever meet someone who seems kind of off? Whether it's a creepy neighbor or random phone number that keeps calling you, Truthfinder has you covered. You can search for people by name, address, phone number, email, and more. Truthfinder can be especially helpful for running confidential background checks on anyone you're planning to meet from online dating apps. Go to truthfinder.com/podcasts for a special offer. That's truthfinder.com/podcasts to access your special offer today.
Lubbock, Texas was transfixed by the spectacle of a love triangle gone bad. For the woman in the middle of it all, Rochelle Shatina, it was an unimaginable situation. She described it to a detective.
Aside from the thought of losing a child, this is the worst situation that I could ever imagine being in.
And I'm sure
ever.
There's no closure.
It's been awful. I don't even know who to trust anymore. I don't know who to talk to, you know.
When Mike Dixon's trial started in November 2014, Rochelle found herself at the center of the case. Her former lover was accused of hiring a friend to murder the love of her life, Joe Saunier, former DA Matt Powell.
Our theory was it was an obsession with Rochelle Shatina. This is vengeance, this is pride, this is jealousy. He spent months and months and months trying to destroy a relationship that she was in. And so I don't know if it was just a vengeance deal for him or if some part in the back of his mind says, you know, I may get her back.
The state's star witness was Mike Dixon's former buddy, Dave Shepard.
When you met with him before the trial, everything was on track?
Yeah, I mean...
Still on the same page? You had a deal?
Yeah, he was already done and received a life without parole sentence.
Dave Shepard had one job to do for the prosecution, get up on the stand and repeat what he'd told detectives.
I pulled a knife out of my bag and I stabbed him in vital organs two or three, four times.
D.A. Powell had Shepard's taped confession, but now he needed the hitman to tell his story in person to the jury.
You're in the courtroom. He's on the stand. All's well.
Well, it wasn't all well very quickly.
Take us through how this all went off the rails.
He started off taking the fifth, and he didn't have any right to take the fifth. Then he'd change his story. Then he would mock me. He would pretend like he couldn't hear. It was really just a sideshow.
A sideshow with Dave Shepard as its ringleader.
If there was probably ever a time in Lubbock County to have a camera in the courtroom, that might have been it.
But cameras weren't allowed in the room when Shepard told the jury his confession was a complete fabrication. He now said he'd acted alone and that Dixon had nothing to do with the murder.
Are you thinking that I can't save this?
Well, you know, what we tried to do was when he starts denying everything, we show the videotape to the jury and see just the difference in demeanor between him on that videotape and the guy we were seeing in the courtroom.
You wanted him hurt, and then it gradually developed into having him killed.
You really had to think on your feet.
Yeah, it was something. In 20-something years of doing this job, I've never been part of something quite like that before.
It hasn't been fun and hasn't been good and hasn't been entertaining.
And Shepard stuck to his new story when his daughter visited him at the Lubbock County Jail after he testified.
As far as Dr. Saunier's death, nobody's involved in that but me. It was a terrible accident, my carelessness and stupidity, okay? Nobody's responsible for that except me. You need to understand that. It was not intended. I wasn't paid to do that.
Why would you make the statement that Mike paid you to do it if he didn't pay you to do it?
Because my attorneys, what they had told me, you know, when I did that statement to the police, my attorneys told me I needed to sell it.
Shepard's about face was pure gold for Mike Dixon's attorneys, Dan Hurley and Frank Sellers.
This is huge for your defense strategy. Were you then surprised when he did that?
That's what he consistently told me. No, Mike, did not pay. He didn't want anybody harmed. That was all me. Mike didn't have anything to do with that.
And the defense had its own star witness, Dr. Mike Dixon. Dixon's attorneys hoped if the jurors heard from the man himself, they too would be convinced he was innocent.
So what does Dr. Dixon acknowledge was really in the works?
He acknowledged that he was trying his hardest to get proof of Joseph Sanye being with other women and not being committed to Rochelle Shatina.
On the stand, Dixon stated he never asked Shepard to kill Dr. Sonia. What he did admit to was cooking up schemes to sabotage Rochelle's new relationship. He said he sent Shepard to install cameras at Sonia's house, cameras he hoped would capture Rochelle's boyfriend with other women.
He was going to use these photographs to show Rochelle that Dr. Sonia was not who she believed that he was.
The defense argued when Shepard arrived at Sonia's house, he went rogue and committed a brutal murder, which was never part of that plan.
What is Mike Dixon guilty of?
Where do we start?
Capital stupidity of the highest degree and trusting David Shepard.
What is Mike Dixon not guilty of?
Capital murder. Murder. He never knew that this was going to happen. He never dreamed that it would be like this.
After weeks of testimony, the jury was given the case. And they faced this dilemma about the state's key witness.
You had to make a choice. Believe story A, that was in the video confession with Dave Shepard, or believe story B, what the man was telling you essentially to your face in that courtroom.
That's true. And that became a turning point for some of the jurors.
Jury foreman Doug Moore believed story A, Shepard's taped confession, that Mike Dixon hired him to kill Dr. Sonia. And Moore expected everyone in the jury room would agree. He was wrong, because when the jurors took their first vote,
we had 10 guilty and 2 not guilty.
But they kept talking. Juror Eric Knight said there wasn't enough evidence to convict Dixon. He found Shepard to be bizarre.
There was something not right with him. Crazy, unstable. I'm not a doctor, I don't know for sure, but In my mind, I got the impression that something was not right.
And he had a hard time believing this respected doctor was a criminal mastermind.
Was it plausible that he did the murder for hire? Of course. Yeah, anybody, given a weak moment, could have done that. I just didn't see it as being that he wanted to kill somebody else. It didn't seem as being that vindictive.
The jurors deliberated for hours and into the next day. But as they kept going,
it began to become obvious that we had holdouts who were not going to change their mind.
They were deadlocked. So they sent a note to the judge, and he declared a mistrial. Joe Sonier's sister Missy was numb.
I never thought about a mistrial. It was, what? We've done all of this. We've sat here for all of these days for nothing.
But for Dixon's attorneys, this was a victory.
It was, in my opinion, a huge battle to win, to get a hung jury. Certainly wasn't the war, but it was important.
And they were charging ahead. Dixon would face a second trial in 2015.
Is Mike Dixon going to stop fighting?
No, I don't believe he'll ever stop.
A new trial, a new jury, new problems for the prosecution.
You know, every time you get a second chance, there's goods and bads about that. Usually, retrials are not good for the prosecution. You get further away from the event, you lose witnesses.
On October 26, 2015, it was deja vu at the Lubbock County Courthouse. After a hung jury, Dr. Mike Dixon was back on trial. The once prominent plastic surgeon was accused of hiring Dave Shepard to murder Joe Sonia. For Sonia's family, it was time to put on their game face.
I decided before the second trial that we should be confident as a family and support the DA and really push this thing forward.
How were you going to do things differently this time around?
You know, every time you get a second chance, there's goods and bads about that. Usually, retrials are not good for the prosecution. You get further away from the event, you lose witnesses. But I think what we tried to do, we tried to streamline it better.
The state didn't call Dave Shepard to testify a second time. Instead, prosecutors played his taped confession.
I point the weapon, discharge several times.
And this jury heard from Paul Reynolds, Shepard's friend, and the man whose tip to police cracked the case wide open. Reynolds didn't testify in the first trial, but now in court, he backed up key details of what Shepard said on the tape, including that his friend planned the murder with Mike Dixon.
He was obviously obsessing about me.
And at this trial, Rochelle Shatina was a key witness for the state once again.
I think she painted a picture of Mike Dixon. It was important for her to testify. There was no way we were not going to get away with putting her on the stand.
He was just emotionally cruel.
Rochelle painted a dark picture of Dixon. She shared a similar one with detectives.
He'd pick out your weak point, and then when he could, he would use it against you. He was just mean. He was a mean man, you know, and he presented himself kind of like underdog, as the mild-mannered, kind person. But he was just, it was the worst relationship that I've ever had in my entire life.
Rochelle said when she moved on with Dr. Joe Saunier, she found her forever love. But Dixon didn't seem willing to let her go.
He was obsessive when he was trying to get me back with him.
The state also pointed to something strange Dixon did a few days after the murder. He tried to destroy messages on his cell phone.
He erases the phone, resets it, and jumps into the swimming pool just to make sure.
With the phone?
With the phone, yes, with the phone.
Dixon eventually turned his phone over to the police, and a forensic expert was able to retrieve about half of his texts. What was in those messages, the state said, proved its case.
There were a series of urgent texts between Shepard and Dixon in the middle of June. Gotta happen tomorrow. I know, just need him to show. That's why you gotta stick closer to know his whereabouts. Not trying to second guess, but we're getting down to the wire here.
Why is there a wire? Why is there a time limit? Why is it important for him to show? Why is it important for if he shows up, it's over?
What they were doing, D.A. Powell argued, was planning a murder.
But there was no evidence of murder either in the text messages.
Yeah, but are you going to put evidence in a text message that said, go kill the guy? Obviously, you're not going to do that. Instead of saying killing somebody, you'd say, put it on him. You know, can't wait for him to get home. You know, all I need is an opportunity. Get it done.
On July 10th, 2012, the day of the murder, there were 37 texts and 4 calls between Shepard and Dixon. The day after, there were 21 texts, including one Dixon fired off to Shepard once detectives left his house.
Just had a visit from Lubbock PD. Ash said you came by for cigars. They will see our texts and conversations. Stay calm, lay low.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to misconstrue that one. Police are just there, and then all of a sudden you're texting the murderer to lay low.
But once it was the defense's turn, Dixon's attorneys, Frank Sellers and Dan Hurley, argued not one of those messages pointed to a murder for hire.
A lot was made of the text messages between David Shepard and Mike Dixon. They don't look great at
they look horrible.
Value. Something clearly was being planned, but you don't believe that it shows that murder was being planned.
If you're walking down the street and you found that phone on the ground and you picked it up and you looked at the text messages between Mike Dixon and David Shepard, there is no way that you would think that these are texts about a murder. No way.
But if Dixon was innocent, why did he try to erase the contents of his phone?
I think this is a problem people watching will have, is I wouldn't do that. If I had nothing to hide, I wouldn't start destroying all this evidence.
They could say they wouldn't do it until they were in that same situation.
Everybody knows the feeling that when they get pulled over, even when it's just for speeding, and your heart drops and your adrenaline starts to rush. Imagine that on a much, much larger scale, and he's being wrapped up in a murder that he had nothing to do with, in the sense that he never wanted Dr. Saunier dead. He did have a lot to do with David Shepard, but he was terrified, absolutely terrified.
Once again, the best person to make the defense's case was Mike Dixon himself. So for the second time, he took the stand, and he was adamant. Dixon said he wanted dirt to make Sonia look bad in Rochelle's eyes, nothing more.
He absolutely did not ever want David Shepherd to harm Joseph Saunier physically.
After 4 weeks of testimony, the defense closed with this. Where was the proof Mike Dixon wanted Joe Saunier dead? The defense said there was none. Dixon's son Andrew was on edge.
We're just hopeful that this is it and we're going to get him back and he's going to kind of move past this.
Jury deliberations started. Then, just 2 hours later,
we were just talking and then when they came back and said we have a verdict, and we thought he was kidding, that it was so fast.
The jury speaks again.
All these things go through your mind.
I was sobbing uncontrollably.
But this case was far from over. November 18th, 2015, judgment day for Mike Dixon. The former doctor waited for the jury's decision with his son, Andrew.
We got to actually sit back there with him and talk to him. It kind of honestly helped the nerves a little bit to see how he was, you know, and just at least be there with him.
And Andrew was by his dad's side for what came next. After deliberating for a scant 2 hours, the jury announced there was a verdict.
And then you're thinking, is that good? Is that bad? You know, I mean, all these things go through your mind.
For Andrew, it was bad. Very bad. His dad was found guilty on 2 counts of capital murder.
They kept saying, guilty, guilty, guilty. Or, you know, yes, I found him guilty. And it was like a bad dream.
But Joe Saunier's family waited years to hear that one word.
If I was sobbing uncontrollably, I couldn't keep it together because this was just a release. And it felt so nice to know that we had gotten justice finally.
I immediately just thought, it's over. We did it. It's over. We got him.
Anything to say, Dr. Dixon?
Dixon, the wealthy, talented surgeon, was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. But his attorneys promised this wasn't the end.
We believe that this is round two of a deep and serious war. And we intend to do everything we can for the Dixon family and for Mike Dixon.
That included an appeal filed in 2016, a year after Dixon's conviction. Matt Powell saw the filing as routine.
I remember getting their brief, and there was nothing there that we said, oh gosh, I'm worried about that. The issues that were brought up were the same that we'd seen on hundreds of cases.
Did you just kind of dismiss it for the most part?
I don't know if you dismiss it, but you don't worry about it.
Powell left the district attorney's office and went into private practice. And not long after, he got an unwelcome surprise. A Texas appeals court overturned Dixon's murder conviction. The former doctor would get a new trial.
The thought never crossed my mind that there would be a successful appeal on the case.
Dixon's appeal was won on 2 issues, how police collected certain cell phone evidence and restrictions on public access to the courtroom on a few occasions. And in January 2019, after 3 years in prison, Dixon was released on $2 million bond. He was a free man, but his troubles were far from over. Lubbock prosecutors filed their own appeal to a higher court. It was a Hail Mary.
It's extremely rare that the Court of Criminal Appeals grants discretionary review of a criminal case, even a serious case like this.
But the higher court did take this one. And in January 2020, it ruled in favor of the prosecution. Dixon's conviction was reinstated. And a few months later, in the midst of a pandemic, he was once again put behind bars.
Is this where you take a deep breath?
Yeah, I took a sigh of relief, and there's some joy there. There's some relief.
But only some relief.
So this is remarkably still not over.
Yeah, still not over. There's other issues the court said that the appellate team for the defense could address.
But by 2022, a Texas appeals court affirmed one of Dixon's murder convictions, meaning he will continue to serve a sentence of life without the possibility of parole. However, Dixon's defense team has petitioned a higher court to review his case. As for the Sonier family, they take comfort in Joe's legacy. We spoke to them after that second trial.
Does he continue to guide you?
Any decision in life, I like to ask or think, what would Joe do in this situation? Because he always took the right track.
I think that I'm a better father because of the way my dad raised me. I know I'm a better husband, I'm a better friend, and I hope that he is proud of me, and I know that he is proud of me.
When I think about him, I think about how he was, he always pushed himself to be the best, but most of all, I just miss my big brother.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.